At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The five key things that happened in the economy this week coming up on the broadcast. All right, maybe it was only four. I don't know. Why we don't fix our bridges. And hey, happy Furlough Friday, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 24th of May. Glad you could be with us. And I'll tell you, this was one of those weeks where the goings-on in business and the economy came quick and they came hard. Ben Bernanke on the Hill, Apple on the Hill, Jamie Dimon kept his jobs, both of them. That and more coming up in the next 4.5 minutes of live radio. John Carney is with us from CNBC. Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. They are in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so Lee, I'll tell you what. We're going to have more on Bernanke and quantitative easing coming up in a second. But I want to ask you whether or not you think Ben Bernanke has now become an enabler of congressional inaction, whether by quantitative easing he just is letting Congress fritter it away.
I don't think so. I think there's many other factors driving Congress's inaction on many, many fronts. But, you know, look, this has been one of the driving forces of the stock market's rise.
Right.
And I think everyone is freaking out about when it's going to stop. That's the biggest question, I think, impacting the markets, more than profits, more than other external factors, more than anything.
Totally agree. And he actually said this week, John, that, you know, depends on the data. We'll figure out when we're going to stop this QE thing. But I want to get back to my question. You don't think that the Fed doing as much as it has let Congress sort of not even worry about it?
I think Congress would be have to do something if the Fed wasn't taking the kind of actions it's doing.
Yeah.
But I also think Lee's right when she says that Congress doesn't really need an enabler. They're plenty dysfunctional on their own.
All right. Fair enough. Lee, just quickly, because I have those four things I have to get to. He did not instill confidence, right? He did not give the message that Congress wanted to hear.
No, he didn't. But he also, I mean, he was sort of all over the map. He was, you know, if you watch the markets, it was up and down. And he also spoke in this sort of obtuse way that, you know, brought to mind Alan Greenspan for a lot of people.
Yeah,
so,
yes, it did.
And people love nothing more than trying to parse what is going to happen. And, you know, he sort of hinted, yeah, it could happen. We could ease off in the next meeting or two.
Right.
And that's a lot earlier than a lot of people thought.
Right. I think that's all way overblown, by the way. People are just paying it. Look, if we get good economic – we didn't learn anything this week that we didn't know before that,
right.
Which was if the economic data is really good, the Fed will stop having to supply so much money into the system. And
true,
if the economic data isn't really good, they're going to keep doing it.
That's true. But this is the very first time that he even went anywhere near articulating anything. So
right.
That's what – the mere mention of anything is what can spook so easily.
Right. All right. We're going to move on. John Carney. Tim Cook, the CEO, of Apple, goes to the Hill this week, they played patty cake with him over taxes. Political sideshow or substantive effort at tax reform?
I actually think I learned something. I had no idea that Apple had sort of you know, mastered the tax code to such an extent that they, you know, that they don't exist anywhere for tax purposes. It's, you know, it's miraculous.
It's that whole Apple loves simplicity thing, right, Lee? I mean, that's just they're going to vaporize.
Yeah, of course, exactly. But I mean, look, the headlines: a U.S. giant company avoids taxes on overseas billions. That sounds like a headline from The Onion. I mean, that's just not news. That's like what everybody does. I hate to be so cynical, but it's true. I mean, this is, you know, the degrees to which U.S. companies go to avoid taxes. It's legal, you know? It's right. Permissible. The tax code is the problem.
I love these Congress guys getting all upset about the rules that they made.
Well, that's the conversation I had with Carl Levin, and he was not even willing to entertain that issue. All right, moving on. Jamie Dimon, Lee, keeps both his jobs after threatening basically to quit if he gets stripped of the chairman title. What does this say about the prospects for substantive reform of the way Wall Street works?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, he won by quite a landslide. You know, fighting regulation is his next big challenge. I mean, J.P. Morgan is really facing a lot, even more than the other banks. But all of Wall Street has been quite successful at fighting it so far. He does seem to be quite resilient. So I think if this is any indicator, I think he stands a pretty good chance on that front as well. But it was pretty strong. I mean, it was the proposal to split votes, to split roles, was really hands down voted down. So,
John, what do you think this means, actually, just picking up on Lee's point quickly now of the prospects for Jamie Dimon fighting regulatory reform?
I think he's going to be encouraged in his endeavors in that respect.
Emboldened, one might say?
Yes. I mean, look, Jamie, you know,
That's remember Mr. that Dimon he stood, to you, pal.
Yeah, he faced down Ben Bernanke in person. He's had, you know, he's been very critical of a lot of aspects of financial regulation.
Right.
And now he faced down, you know, all these big pension funds that were coming after him, and he beat them. I think he's just going to, you know, this is, you know, Dimon's world. We just borrow in it.
Diamonds are
forever. The question is, what is better for shareholders? And that's who voted. And that's, you know, the stock's up
21%. Profits, so. That's what's better.
Yeah,
all right,
exactly.
We got to go. Lee Gallagher from Fortune and John Carney from CNBC. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Kai.
You too.
All right, be good. On Wall Street today, mezza mezza, consin con sa. Hi, Kai, for you Mandarin speakers out there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This is a four-day weekend for more than 100,000 federal workers. It is, though, something of a mixed blessing. About 5% of the entire civilian federal workforce has today off without pay because of the sequester. Furlough Friday, it's being called, which obviously stinks for them. But would the rest of us even notice they're not working? Market Police's Jeff Tyler went in search of answers.
You'd notice that the IRS is closed today if you call their hotline to report identity theft.
Due to the current budget situation, all IRS offices are closed today.
Also closed today, the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA. Jackie Simon is with the American Federation of Government Employees, the union representing EPA workers.
With EPA closed, it's a get-out-of-jail-free card day for polluters. There's no one there at EPA to enforce our clean air and clean water laws. No one there to hold polluters accountable.
It's also Furlough Friday at HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Linda Couch with the National Low-Income Housing Coalition says tornado victims will notice that the HUD office is closed.
If I was someone in Oklahoma who was trying to get a list of federally subsidized units, then today's a really bad day to have a furlough.
Earlier today, I stopped by the Los Angeles office of HUD. 52-year-old Mary Woods had just been turned away by building security.
I was going to the HUD, but they said it closed today and Monday. Well, Monday is a holiday, so that's understandable. But I wonder why it closed today.
Why did you come to HUD today?
To try to get some information about low-income housing and to see can they help me pay for move-in fees.
Woods is currently homeless. She's trying to change that. But if she wants help from HUD, she'll have to come back Tuesday. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The world's biggest consumer products company has a new CEO, in a manner of speaking. Today, Procter & Gamble said it's pulling A.G. Lafley out of retirement to come back and run things again. JCPenney did pretty much the same thing last month, which does kind of make you ask, big companies putting old leaders back in charge? What's up with that? Shannon Mullen reports.
JCPenney fired its CEO and rehired his predecessor after big financial losses and a steep drop in sales. Tough to find someone new who's willing to take that on. Bob McDonald is leaving Procter & Gamble amid complaints that he wasn't adapting P&G fast enough to a more competitive global market.
I think in both of those cases, I mean, there clearly were pressures from the outside.
David Larker is co-director of the Center for Leadership Research and Development at Stanford. He says putting the old guard back in charge can help stabilize a company.
The board says, you know, here's people that we know. They know the company. We felt comfortable with them before, and it buys them a little time to figure out what they want to do next.
Including reassess the company's talent pipeline. McDonald had been with P&G for 33 years. He worked his way up to chief operating officer before taking over as CEO 4 years ago. So the shakeup there came as something of a surprise, says Mike Tobin, a partner at Vantage Leadership Consulting.
P&G is recognized as one of the top 10 leadership development firms in the world. And so, you know, they stumbled.
So what does it say about other wannabe CEOs at the company that Procter & Gamble pulled Lafley out of retirement to take over? Steve Meyer is general manager of the Corporate Executive Board Company.
The challenge that most organizations have in identifying a leader is finding the right person at the right time. Sometimes that'll be a candidate who's within their own walls and sometimes not.
P&G hasn't said whether Lafley's tenure is temporary, but the head of its board says he'll be expected to manage the ongoing succession process as well as boost the company's performance. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
As John and Lee and I were talking about, Ben Bernanke spent some quality time with Congress this week, the Joint Economic Committee to be precise, explaining what the Fed might do and when it might do it. Thing is, you can't talk about Bernanke these days without talking about quantitative easing, the Fed's strategy of buying bonds to keep interest rates low and, in theory, the economy at least stumbling along. But quantitative easing is controversial. It's even been called a Jedi mind trick. Well, this weekend being the 30th anniversary of Return of the Jedi, we thought we'd run with that. Marketplace's David Weinberg takes us to a galaxy far, far away.
After Luke Skywalker found out that Darth Vader was his father, he accused Obi-Wan Kenobi of lying to him. Obi-Wan said it wasn't a lie from a certain point of view.
A certain point of view?
Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
Now, I'm going to say that again because it's a little hard to hear. You're going to find that the truths we cling to depend greatly on our point of view. So, is quantitative easing the Darth Vader of economic policy? Well, it depends on your point of view. You might say that QE has spurred lending, created jobs, and has kept inflation below 2%. More like a young Anakin Skywalker before he turned to the dark side.
He was the best star pilot in the galaxy.
Or, like many of QE's critics, you might say it's only a matter of time before it causes inflation. It's creating artificial price bubbles, and it certainly hasn't had any noticeable impact on unemployment.
Give yourself to the dark side.
Bernanke says he has no plans of ending the Fed's $89 billion a month spending on treasuries and mortgage-backed securities.
It is the only way you can save your friends.
So, will quantitative easing save us from the dark side? We'll just have to wait for QE Episode 4, directed by Ben Bernanke, featuring an all-star cast of commercial banks. Let's just hope it has a happy ending. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up, hey buddy, can you spare a dime?
Well, I get a phone call. My wife will tell me, oh, so-and-so wants to talk to you, knowing look in her eye.
But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Wall Street basically treaded water today. The Dow Industrials added 8 points, not even a 10th percent, ended at 15,303. The NASDAQ stayed right where it was, 3459. The S&P 500 did pretty much the same thing, 1649 there. For the week gone by, the Dow off 0.3%. The NASDAQ ditched a full percentage point, and the S&P 500 also dropped 1%. The big story today was Abercrombie & Fitch. Shares of the clothing retailer shed 8% following a deeper-than-expected first-quarter loss. Investors cheered the return of A.G. Lafley to Procter & Gamble that we were telling you about. Shares bubbled up 4% there. Bond prices, well, they had pretty much steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stood still at 2.01%. That was the name of the game on Wall Street today. Standing still, you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The U.S. remembers fallen soldiers on Memorial Day. The New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ will be closed for the holiday. A special day at media company Viacom. Chairman Sumner Redstone celebrates his 89th birthday. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The most famous bridge in the country today lies about 60 miles north of Seattle, Washington. It also lies partly in the water after last night's collapse. The bridge over the Skagit River had been declared functionally obsolete, which basically means old, but not necessarily in bad enough shape to shut down. It's one of tens of thousands of bridges in this country that need repairs that we're just not doing, even though we know about it. Robert Meyer is the co-director of the Risk Management and Decision Processes Center at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. Bob, it's good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you.
So here we are with another bridge collapsing, and yet it doesn't seem that there's any urgency about fixing the infrastructure in this country.
I'm not at all sort of surprised, unfortunately, that this happened. We have something like $2.2 trillion of repairs that tend to be needed. So in many respect cases, it's just a matter of time before these things happen.
Of course, problem is we don't have $2.5 trillion, do we?
No, we don't. That's definitely a problem that we have to face, and it's one that we collectively have to do. And unfortunately, it's a type of expenditure that's similar to the type of dilemma that we have maintaining our own households and maintaining our own health. Preventive maintenance is something which is an expenditure we don't like to have to lay out.
Okay, but you know what? I've got a list of like a dozen things at my house that really ought to be done to save me some money. Is that sort of what's going on in the government?
Pretty much. I think there's a tendency to kind of think that somehow or another the legislators who are out there are somehow different than just you and me making our day-to-day decisions. But a lot of the people who kind of postpones funding for bridge repair are probably the same people that drive around with underinflated tires and don't repair the roofs and so on. So it just carries over.
The problem, of course, is that when these bridges collapse, I mean, we were lucky yesterday, but in Minneapolis 5-6 years ago, you know, people died.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And what was particularly tragic about that was, of course, that, like in many of these others, there were warnings beforehand that this thing was structurally deficient. And as it turned out, the size of the cost of the maintenance on that was much smaller than what the cost would be in terms of replacing a whole bridge. And, of course, it would spare the lives of 13 people who died.
It does also seem that there is a tendency to build shiny new things, whether they're bridges or highways or whatever, at the expense of fixing up the rusty old ones.
I think we love to build bridges. We don't like to maintain them. And I think a lot of it has a political origin. We have an expression, an acronym is called NIMTU, not in my term of office. And I think that's often the way a lot of politicians think about the whole process, that it's sort of very easy to get votes on promises of building bridges, building new infrastructures. It's very difficult to get votes when it comes to spending taxpayer money to maintain them.
Where do we go then? I mean, we're not going to find $2.5 trillion to fix this, so what do we do?
Well, the sad part is that then unfortunately it takes the significant loss to trigger action. And I think that that's certainly not a good solution where we're just going to have to wait for to experience losses to all of a sudden trigger to motivate government to spend.
Sadly, we are prisoners of human nature, though, huh?
Absolutely.
Bob Meyer is the co-director of the Risk Management and Decision Processes Center at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. Bob, thanks a bunch.
Thanks.
Way down deep at the bottom of the budget debate in Washington, past the sequester and tax reform and how much we can afford to pay to fix up our infrastructure, is this issue. How much should we spend on the government programs that we've all come to call the safety net? The trick is that safety nets come in all shapes and sizes, governmental and otherwise. So we've been asking for your thoughts online about your safety nets, and we're going to share some of them every now and then. Safety net confessionals is what we're calling them. And the first comes from a guy in San Diego. When we asked him what his safety net looks like, he was pretty clear about it.
I'm the safety net.
From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark takes it from there.
This is Frank.
My name is Frank Paiano.
But to his friends and family, he's also known by another name.
Bank of Frank. Right.
Or, since he lives right by the border,
Banco Franco.
In Spanish. Now, plenty of people have stories of the rich uncle who helped them once, but Frank, he takes that to a whole new level. He's become a semi-official lender of last resort for his friends, his cousins, the friends of his cousins, when they get in a pinch.
Well, I get a phone call. My wife will tell me, oh, so-and-so wants to talk to you, knowing look in her eye.
And the deal goes down. On average, he'll charge a small interest rate, 4 to 8%. He's a stockbroker and a professor of financial planning, so as you might guess, he keeps careful track of each loan.
I have a spreadsheet. I know how to use it.
It's true. He went to his computer to show me.
Let's see here, the Bank of Frank loans, current loans.
And it actually says Bank of Frank loans, yeah. Of course, to be a lending institution, even a one-man lending institution, you need money to lend. And Frank didn't start out with much. His dad was a mechanic.
He would work very, very hard. He would work two jobs. It took a toll on the whole family.
Frank figures maybe that's why he's always been a saver.
We would be given a nickel for ice cream at night. And instead of buying ice cream, I would save it. I just thought it was important to have a cushion to fall back on, even as a child.
By the time he was a teenager, that ice cream money had piled up into a big enough cushion that he could share the wealth.
My friends would want to buy a stereo, and I would be the front person.
Then on to bigger things. Someone needed equipment to start a business. Someone's car broke. Someone got sued. Frank says the loans have been paid back in full every time but once. Over the years, he's lent tens of thousands of dollars to more than a dozen people.
People just needed help, and they didn't know who to turn to.
My name is Rolf Menica. I've been helped many times by the Bank of Frank.
Rolf Menica is a self-employed carpenter and a cousin of Frank's wife.
43rd cousins, yes. Something like that.
Yes, estranged twice.
Rolf turned to Frank for money after his divorce and after he owed way more to the IRS than he expected. And most recently, after he moved to Oregon, right as the recession was hitting.
Things didn't work the way I thought and could not earn the kind of money that I was used to earning. And I called up the Bank of Frank to get a short-term loan to be able to move back home and start over.
It didn't take Rolf long to pay the loan back.
Maybe a year? Was it a year?
6 months.
Okay. That was 5 years ago?
No, 2009 to 2010.
You're keeping track of this.
It's on the spreadsheet.
I asked Rolf what would have happened without the Bank of Frank. I would have put more money on credit cards than I should have, he said. And a lot of couch surfing. Then he thought about it some more.
I don't really know what would have happened. I've always just thought of it as a big-hearted gesture.
After Rolf left, I asked Frank the question that maybe some of you are wondering right now. Why do you keep bailing people out? Couldn't they have saved like you? Frank told me he doesn't think we're all the same. He is good at saving. Rolf is a beautiful carpenter.
You see that? Let me put the lights on.
And then he starts pointing at things.
He built this. Oh,
an elegant set of bookshelves.
Up here.
A treehouse on the patio.
It looks like the deck of a ship, doesn't it? It's unbelievable.
I could never build something like this, he says, no matter how many years I practiced. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
There's lots more from our Safety Net series, and you can tell us what the safety net means to you at our website. It's marketplace.org. There are going to be the usual barbecues this weekend, small town Memorial Day parades as well. Also, some weddings. 3-day weekends can be handy for out-of-town guests and all that. Some, maybe most of those weddings will cost thousands of dollars, but there is always pressure to keep costs as low as possible, which brings me to this. Target has entered the bridal business with a collection, online only, of wedding and bridesmaids' dresses starting at $70 or so, $70. A good deal? Sure, but will brides be willing to walk down the aisle wearing Target? Sally Herships reports.
Getting married?
wonderful. If only it weren't so expensive. The average tab for the gown alone clocks in at $1,200.
This is the least expensive wedding dress that I know of.
Rachel Leonard is fashion director at Brides Magazine. She says Target's dresses look good online. Brides can choose from cap-sleeved, strapless, cowl neck, ruched, and stay under $130.
So, you know, you could spend more money on a pair of shoes.
Attracting budget-conscious brides. One reason big retailers like J. Crew and Anthropologie are getting into the wedding business. But Target?
It is funny that you can go to a store where you buy your toothpaste and you can also buy a wedding dress.
They have what we'd call a little bit more street cred than some other mass retailers.
Marissa Gluck works with Huge Advertising. She says Target, thanks to its collaborations with designers like Jason Wu and Missoni, has distanced itself from Walmart and Kmart. And I know this is heresy, but it may not even be about the bride. Jen Drexler is a brand consultant with Insight Strategy Group.
Frankly, I think one of the bigger smarts of this decision is the bridesmaids' dresses.
Drexler says while Target is caring for wedding dresses, there are 10 options for bridesmaids.
It tends to be a disposable dress, something you're never going to wear again, even though they promised you you could. And now you have an opportunity to give your bridesmaids a dress that they won't be mad at you for making them buy.
Drexler says, remember, Target invented designer cheap chic, and millions of women have raced down the aisles to buy it. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which 9-year-old Hannah Robertson gives the CEO of McDonald's a talking to. Hannah showed up at the company's shareholder meeting yesterday, accompanied by her mother, who is presumably the actual shareholder here. Anyway, Hannah lined up at the mic during question and answer time and said to CEO Don Thompson, "It would be nice if you stopped trying to trick kids into wanting to eat your food all the time." Thompson said, first off, McDonald's doesn't sell junk food, that his kids eat McDonald's, and that Ronald is really a pretty nice guy. Sure, unless you're afraid of clowns. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow added 8 points, not even a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq stayed right where it started, 34.59. The S&P 500 off 2 points, about two-tenths of 1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here Monday. All right, have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.